I'm the sports professor Rick Haro. Join me for the first edition of Beyond the Scoreboard. Steve Pagliuca, owner of the Boston Celtics and Duke basketball maven and guru. And also we'll ask the difficult question, why are the NFL ratings getting lower? Rick Haro, Beyond the Scoreboard starts now. Sports Professor Rick Haro, the debut episode of Beyond the Scoreboard. It's a show that we really want to make sure is a serious slant on all issues that don't really involve the game itself. News, marketing, business, endorsements, all issues that deal with the trillion-dollar business of sports. Over 50% of the column inches of all of the newspapers today are devoted to this. Some people say business is boring. Well, listen, if you want to gain an advantage over people in the fantasy leagues or at your water cooler or at a bar or just making conversation, this show is for you. I've been in the business for a number of years, teach a sports business, sports law class at Harvard Law School, did a lot of deals for the NFL and NASCAR and brought the heat with other people to South Florida, involved in a lot of the sports deals all over the country. And most important is, a lot of people have an interest in sports business and other aspects of sports, but people don't quite understand the inside information. With this podcast on a regular basis, you're going to hear all of that.
Beyond the Scoreboard, stories of the week. Here's number five.
Owner Mark Davis took a major step last week toward relocating the Raiders to Vegas, but the potential move isn't popular among NFL executives, at least all of them. As it currently stands, Nevada building a $2 billion, 65,000-seat dome stadium in Vegas, and NFL owners characterizing the Raiders' relocation vote as a battle between progressive NFL team owners who want to test the Vegas market and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who may be buying time for an alternate plan to emerge to keep them in Oakland. Apart from the city's reputation as a national gambling hub, other league owners close to the problem cite the desert city's small size as a real concern for the plan's viability. One team official said, in general, we don't like to leave big markets for small ones. That's the biggest issue. Most people aren't crazy about that. Vegas goes from a radioactive sports market to the strong possibility of having two teams before 2020. The appeal isn't gambling, but the 2 million family residents who crave consistent spectator sports. Rams Chargers LA deal and the Vegas Raiders may settle the NFL musical chairs for quite some time. It'll also produce a new Super Bowl, Final Four, NBA All-Star, and other mega event venue in Vegas for everyone to leverage in the future.
Number four.
Despite reportedly engaging in expansion talks with 20 different schools over the past few months, the Big 12 isn't ready to move. The last 3 months full of expansion talks, but following conference meetings, officials announced it would stand firm with 10. The Big 12 interviewed 11 of 20 potential schools, though the league found none to be ideal candidates. Oklahoma president and Big 12 Board of Directors Chair David Boren said the decision was unanimous and no specific schools were discussed or voted on during the 5 hours or so of expansion talk, while Big 12 presidents and chancellors met. Keeping 10 members, the Big 12 still stands far as the smallest of the Power Five, the Pac-12 second smallest with 12, the ACC biggest with 15. And will a smaller size impede the conference's ability to consistently advance to the playoffs? Well, the school's on-field play will tell that. But with the Big 12, expansion was tabled because the economic deal wasn't perfect. Yet, if schools like Oklahoma start looking elsewhere, watch how quickly the Big 12 may reconsider. Now the college football rhetoric shifts the possibility of 6 to 8 teams combined with the mega conference merger into 4 super conferences, neither out of the question in the short term.
Number three.
The golf retail industry might be in a slump, witness the bankruptcy Golfsmith filed this year, but this week's IPO by Massachusetts-based Acushnet, the parent company of Titleist, will peg the market value of the company around $1.7 billion. The record golf industry offering expected to raise roughly $435 million from the sale of 19 million shares at $24. The majority of voting shares retained by Fila Korea, but overall, the $9 billion golf industry is in a decline. Other companies like Nike and Adams exiting golf equipment following successive years of diminishing sales. Acushnet reportedly plans to use the capital to develop new Titleist balls and clubs, hopefully ones that go straight, expand further into the golf clothing and gear, and to continue to grow globally. And what remains to be seen, everybody, is whether this buoyant golf boat will keep all parts of the industry afloat. Luckily, a healthy Tiger Woods is no longer imperative, and the superstar scenario remains diversified. Day, McIlroy, Spieth, and maybe even Fowler.
Number two.
As the NBA prepares to tip off its 2016 season this week, Commissioner Adam Silver still believes North Carolina will host the All-Star Weekend in the near future. This year's NBA All-Star Game moved out of North Carolina following the implementation of that state House Bill 2. Silver said that bringing the 19 All-Star Game to Charlotte, a high priority, but if the bill doesn't change, the game certainly won't be there. Our owners and teams, he said, based all over the country in red states, blue states, purple states. It was a strongly held view that HB2 was inconsistent with the values of the league. The NBA and other professional sports leagues recognize for their progressive values in which equality and inclusivity are both stressed. HB2 scrutinized nationally on its in statement, and North Carolina continues to lose key athletic and non-athletic events due to its existence. NBA been sailing along under the Silver administration with franchise values tripling. But as December 15 becomes D-Day to extend the labor agreement, most folks believe the deal will be done by Thanksgiving. As the league continues its economic stability, it can be aggressive on societal issues, such as influencing the change of this North Carolina law, and that's number two.
Number one.
Of course, what else? The Cubs' 71-year curse appears to be over as Wrigleyville squad heads to the World Series for the first time in seven decades. A crowd of over 42,000 at Wrigley Field made the pitch life and death experience every pitch, while thousands of fans congregated outside to share in the glory, according to the Chicago Tribune. The Cubs are now four wins away from giving fans their first World Series in 108 years, following the 5-0 win over the Dodgers, and they face the Indians with Tuesday night Cleveland. But 3-4-5 in Chicago, guess what? StubHub says $2,200 for a standing room only pass. Conversely, the lowest ticket price for Game 1 at Progressive is about $745. In all, the 2016 Fall Classic shaping up to be one of baseball's most anticipated World Series in many, 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 many years. As franchise values increased almost double in the last five, and as labor peace continues, baseball will grab the headlines from all other sports in this riveting series. Impact on Chicago and Cleveland, historical, generational, and certainly beyond quantification. That's the biggest issues of the week.
This week's Inside the Boardroom segment features Steve Pagliuca, the managing director of Bain Capital Private Equity since 1989. He's a tech guy. He's a financial services guy. He's a media guy. He's a telecommunications guy, but he's also served as managing partner and managing general partner of the Boston Celtics, a Dookie in 1977, Harvard Business School 1982, and a BA from Duke. And by the way, his kid's also on the Duke basketball team. Steve Pagliuca, coming up now.
Steve Pagliuca, really appreciate the time. I'm not sure if we talk about your managing role at Bain Capital or the Celtics. Which one do you want to be introduced as?
Anything's fine. They're both. It's great to be part of organizations that are bigger than yourself, and they both are bigger than me, so it's been great.
Well, that's clear. And obviously, you've done an amazing thing with Bain itself. Talk about the Bain business first, then we'll talk about the Celtics.
Well, Bain has been a fantastic experience for me. I started out as a young consultant. I was actually going to get a doctorate in economics and at Harvard, and I couldn't afford it, so I got a summer job at Bain when it was a small company, the consulting firm. And I enjoyed it so much, they made me a full-time offer, so I just got an MBA and went there. And they had talked about, when I joined, forming something in the future. And this, when I joined, it was 1982. They said, sometime in the future, we're going to take these consulting skills and apply that to investing into businesses. And at the time, BCG, Bain, McKinsey were really developing state-of-the-art business analytic tools.
Right.
But Bain was the first one, and I think to date really the only one, to start a division that would invest and do venture capital in business. Mitt Romney came over and started that, and I joined that in 1989. It's been a great ride.
And it's there's a different perspective between the Bain approach and the McKinsey's and Boston Consulting Group. I mean, you actually analyze and solve problems and have some investment opportunities to solve those problems.
Well, actually, what happened was it started out that way, and then the companies split off in about 1991 or 92. And I think when I left there, Bain was 200 or 300 people. The consulting firm now is 6,000. And when I joined Bain Capital, we were 12 or 15 people, and now it's 1,000 people and global. And I think started out with $36 million doing venture capital. Now it's an $80 billion asset business that's global. It's just been a great run. And it's proven that those consulting skills applied to businesses. And secondly, the theory back then was we put the Bain Partners money and our own money into these deals. So we're very aligned with our investors. We're the most aligned group out there. About somewhere between around 10% of the capital comes from people in the company. So our investors love that you know, we're in there with them side by side and aligned. And then they love that we can, in these markets, apply those consulting skills to kind of grow and transform businesses. So the model has really worked out well over the last 30 years or so.
Well, and the bottom line, of course, then is that everything you learn helps you in everything else you do. So you purchase a piece of the Celtics. Talk about that story and how that happened.
Well, that's a great story. I got a call from Wick Grosbeck one day, and he had known me. Our daughters went to school together, and his wife had said he needed a partner to buy the Celtics. And his wife said, I knew basketball. I played at Duke. And I think I had built a little small half court at my house because I'm a basketball fanatic. And she said, you ought to call Steve because he's done LBOs and he could be helpful. And Wick called me, and we'd known each other a little bit from school, but really hit it off. And he really sat me down, and I showed up my Celtics regalia, and he said, let's partner up and go on this quest to buy the Celtics. And at the time, that was in 2003. The team hadn't won in 16 years, right, and the revenues were going down, and it wasn't the day that we have today. Yeah. But we really did it. We both loved the Celtics, and we did it as a labor of love to try to bring a championship back, and we were able to do that in 6 years, thankfully, and now we're trying to do it again.
Incredible transformation, the speed with which you restored a sense of business values and brand values of the Celtics is beyond anything you could study in business 101. How'd you do it?
We really had three strategic objectives when we purchased the club. The first one, we just wanted to win a championship. And there's a whole set of things underneath there. We needed to get more scouting, invest in state-of-the-art analytics, invest in coaching, invest in doing better in the draft. So that whole basketball side was really important. And then the second piece was, whether you win or lose, we wanted to make it a better experience for the fans. And at the time we bought the club, they really hadn't used much technology. They had an old video board that was grainy, and they weren't really emphasizing, let's get the players engaged with the fans and the club engaged with the plans. So we wanted to improve the fan experience. And the third piece was we wanted to make the Celtics, given the incredible brand and what they do in the community, much more relevant to the community. So we started the Boston Celtics Shamrock Foundation, with our whole ownership group. And that's become one of the leading, you know, kind of charitable through sports organizations in the country. And we've given away millions of dollars and impacted many, many groups. So that was our plan. We knew we could get better on the community front, and we have. We knew we could make the fan experience better. What we didn't know is, you know, could we actually get a championship? And Danny Ainge and Doc Rivers and Brad Stevens, you know, have done a fantastic job both winning one, and now we're on the way rebuilding again.
What's it like in an environment where you have a baseball-crazed World Series champion, most recently Red Sox, you have a Patriots dynasty, and the Bruins are everybody's team too. It's pretty competitive in this market, isn't it?
You know, the funny thing is, it's actually not. We're one of the few markets that I've seen in the country that we are very close to the Red Sox ownership group, mm-hmm. the Patriots. Bob and Jonathan Kraft are longtime friends before they even bought the team. Boston's a small town. The Bruins are our landlord and partner in the Celtics, and our success has been their success because they own the building and the building's getting filled. So we do lots of things together. We all work with the Children's Hospital. So it's not that competitive. And secondly, we think we have the greatest sports fans in the world. When the team was losing for 16 years, when we didn't own it, people like myself, and we were still going to the games. They still had 16,000 a night. It wasn't a capacity, but it still had a great following. When we bought the team and they knew we were investing and gave it hope, the sales started to go up, the stadium started to fill up. And they really bought into the fact that you had a group, an ownership group that broad-based throughout the city that really wanted to turn the franchise around. So we're really thankful to be in a town like this where in the tough times the fans support us and we owe them a championship.
I'll bet you if you took some kind of a metric and you created it and you talked about fan avidity, plus if there was some way to quantify getting along with other owners, it's a pretty robust combination.
It is. And so we just haven't had that sense of competition because the Red Sox have done great and they're filled up. The Patriots have got championships. We have a championship and we're in the finals and contending again. And the Crafts just came to our game. The Henrys just came to our game. We go to their games. And so it's a virtuous circle in Boston. The only problem is, you know, the people who've grown up here in the last 20 years, the kids are very blessed. I mean, many cities, they don't have a championship in anything.
Right.
And we've had parades here, I don't know, 7-8 times for the various sports teams.
And Boston Marathon, incredible, charitable, Boston Strong, that whole feeling. Disappointed about the Olympic process, the way it turned out?
Absolutely. I think we got defeated by Mother Nature. Things were starting to go well at the Olympics, and we had a fantastic plan that would have been very accretive to the city, would have created a tax base from 800,000 today in an area by Wadette Circle to hundreds of millions, created 8,000 units of housing, 1,200 low-income housing, 100,000 jobs. So it's very compelling, and no money from the government involved at all. I think when that snowstorm hit, it put a malaise on us. People couldn't get to work, and they said, how are we going to have the Olympics? We can't even get to work. Now, the funny thing is, L.A. is doing a great job out there. They don't even have a T. So you don't really need a T for the Olympics, but it really set us back. It had a slow start, then set us back with some politics, unfortunate politics. I really think it could have been fantastic. The good news is, out of that effort, there's been now a focus on that Wadette Circle area, which right now is very underutilized. And there are already plans, the mayor's looking at plans for his kind of 2030 plan, incorporating a lot of things we did for the Olympics. And we also made a big effort to bring everything we learned out to L.A. So we had done a massive financial plan. I think people said it was the largest plan ever, 10 years in advance of the Olympics, with data on every site and every revenue and every dollar and how you would do it. And the L.A. committee, we give that all to them. We've given our insurance people to them. So we hope to get them off to a good start and hope they win it.
Well, and Scott Blackman, the USOC guys, and Larry Probst, and all of those people are obviously tremendously appreciative of that. And the untold story that you just kind of told a little bit of, the legacy factor of an Olympics properly done can be beneficial to the local community just by putting the bid package together, even if you don't get the games.
Absolutely. And you know, look, I didn't like the outcome, but the process was a great process, and it brought together academia, it brought together the government, it brought together business people to focus on what is Boston going to look like in 2030. We all viewed it as using the Olympics as a catalyst for Boston. It wasn't so Boston could build the Taj Mahal. We had the new 2020 agenda allowed us to build a temporary stadium that you'd buy for $175 million in a box and put it up. Then you take it down and you have all this land that you could use for housing and retail and all the things we desperately need in Boston. So it got a great dialogue going. And I've actually never seen that community come together as well as it did for that. Unfortunately, you know, a large snowstorm and some I think, very sophisticated political opposition with the internet and the rest set us back. And I wish I could have done a better job getting the message out there. But there wasn't enough time to turn around public sentiment without risking losing the games. And so L.A., I think, has a really good shot. And it was best for us to step back and say, you know, let's have America get it, even though Boston is not going to get it.
Which it looks like they will, we hope. From international audience, we don't know. The bottom line, as far as shifting gears to the NBA itself, mid-80s, franchise prices, $32.5 million. Now, you know, nearly a billion, well over that. Is it the Steve Ballmer bid? Is it the Adam Silver, the David Stern? Is it the partnership with the players? Is it your particular partners as owners? Is it the TV contract? There are a lot of issues. Combination?
I think it's all of the above. And really what you've seen, if you look at the major driver of the increase in value in sports, it's the fact that people can get entertainment in any way they want it right now. And the traditional model of, you know, when I grew up, three channels and commercials, that's been all turned on its head with TiVo, with on-demand, with the internet, with clips. And so what's happened is sports in general, and the NBA, I think, in particular, have been a hot commodity because people really want to see it live. Secondly, in today's sports, you know, the NBA is a non-contact sport and a fantastic game where the fans and television get really close to that game. It's a great television game. It's a great game to be in stadium. And so it has really captured the consciousness. I think David Stern was a genius, you know, in building the league. And Adam Silver has been there for many, many years. And he's also a genius. So we've been blessed, I think, to have two of the best commissioners that I've ever seen in sports.
And a seamless transition.
A seamless transition back-to-back. And Adam is of the generation that, you know, he's kind of grown up in media with the internet, you know, with Snapchat, with Instagram. And the NBA under David and Adam has really gotten ahead of that, and they've gotten global as well. So I think the real factors is that those properties are very, very valuable as you have lots of television bandwidth and broadcast and content needs. And this is the number one content that, you know, you can't fast forward through. You want to see the games. So it's great for advertisers. It's global and it's growing. So that's really increased the value.
Do people around the world know the Celtics?
Absolutely. I got back in the fall from attending our game in Madrid. And I have some great pictures on my cell phone of you walk in the hotel. There's like a sea of green with Celtics uniforms. And I thought, oh, there's fans from the U.S. coming over. It was all Spaniards. I go in the stadium and I was getting pulled into the stands to get pictures with people with Celtics jerseys. The stadium was like a quarter or a half green. So the game has really globalized. And this media has been a particular, you know, enhancer of that, a catalyst for that, because people can watch our games. It's one of the number one things in China is people going to work. They'll put on the cell phone, they'll watch a Celtics game, you know, while they're going to work. We have huge contracts over there that have gone up exponentially. And Europe, the game is growing itself, and so it's just kind of feeding upon itself as a global game where the whole world loves it.
What does the NBA look like 5 years from now, broadly defined?
I think you'll see the NBA continue to grow, continue to prosper. You know, I don't know if we'll have teams in other continents or spaces, but I think we probably will in the next 10 to 20 years. Right now, the content is being, you know, voraciously looked at in Europe and in Asia, in South America, and when I go to the Middle East, you know, people have Celtics hats on. So the game is growing in popularity. I think it's the second largest growing game in China. It's now number two, moved to number two, right behind soccer. Yeah. And I think you'll see soccer and basketball becoming huge global sports.
All right, let's have some fun now. Let's talk Duke. You have played, kids playing there, my daughters. It's an incredible basketball program. The ACC is incredible as well. Coach K, amazing. What's the one thing you could say about the Duke basketball brand?
It's about as close as a religious experience as you can have when you go into that stadium and it just pulsates with the kind of camaraderie. It's fun. Everybody's jumping up and down. Faces are painted. It brings the whole university together, and I think it's college sports at its best. You know, Coach K runs a high integrity program. The individuals, I know the individuals on that team, they're incredible individuals, and he's had a history of that for, I think, 36 years now. So we're very blessed that a couple of my sons could play there. Yeah, I played there. I was the worst player on the worst Duke team in the last 50 years. It's kind of like Bob Beamon's long jump record. Yeah. You know, it won't be broken. I'm probably the worst forever that ever played for Duke.
Well, that's a silly comment to make, but I'm sure you don't really mean it that way. But you treasure your memories, and your kids treasure their memories.
Absolutely. I treasure my memory when I was there. Yeah. You know, I was there in a period where we were there with three coaches, I think, over 4 years, and I left coinciding with Coach K coming in a couple of years later. And Coach K, Bill Foster and Coach K has really turned the program around and brought it back to its heydays of the 60s. So
that's 37 years ago?
I think he came 36 years ago.
Shane Battier told me that he majored in and graduated in comparative religions at Duke, and I thought for the longest time he meant Coach K against Dean Smith, but I guess it's there are other.
That's it. The funny thing is my oldest son who played at Duke, I brought him down there to look at Duke. He was a really good basketball player here at Belmont Hill, and he fell in love with Duke. And we went to senior night, and Shane Battier was on that team.
Mm, interesting.
And it's a great story on that team. Trajan Langdon got hit by a Georgia Tech player. Yeah. Knocked out, and with Duke was down 15-0, and they wheeled Trajan Langdon out, and so Coach K called the guys and said, they can't do that to our guy. You know, we've got to really win this game. And Duke scored the next like 28 points and destroyed the team, and then we went back and we got to meet Shane Battier, who became a very great role model for my son. So we go way back with Duke.
It's a full circle, quite clearly, from a college basketball perspective, and we've seen both sides of the one and done. How do you change it? Is, first of all, do you believe in the system the way it is today? And second, how could you maneuver it or change it if you had the power to do it?
Well, I would change it if I could do it. It's going to take, I think, a complex set of negotiations with the players' union. Mm-hmm. My personal opinion is it is very valuable for these young men to stay in school. And there may be some creative ways to do that, and we've got to work through that with the players' union, with the NBA. But I think the there's nothing better than having a college education. The more maturity, I think it's good for everyone. Now I see the issue if someone like LeBron is, you know, and he's the rare exception. Many of the players are not ready like LeBron was, and they're for everyone like LeBron, there are five or six that are going to take 3, 4, 5 years to get ready. Some like Sean Livingston come out and they're slight and they get injured. So I'd love to see a system where we can find a way to have a win-win where the players stay longer in school, but we don't deny them their opportunity as well. So there's a lot of creative ways we can do that, and it's one of the things that certainly I'm going to talk about and work on for the next few years.
Well, you may have the ability to transcend a lot of these issues, because from a coach's perspective, every coach would say he coaches based on what the rules allow. Don't let me coach differently than what the rules allow. I'll coach up to the rules.
Absolutely. But it's something that's got to be discussed, and hopefully we can get a win-win situation for the kids and the players and the schools.
Celtics and Duke, you certainly have your fill of brands, and really appreciate the time, and not only that, but ongoing continued success. Bain Capital as well. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, I've been very fortunate to be part of these places, which are a lot bigger than me, and I'm very blessed to do that, and hopefully we'll keep on winning in the Celtics and Duke and Bain Capital as well.
This week's Off the Beaten Track comes from a number of different places. The NBA has a new official motor oil, motor fuel, and engine lubricant. ExxonMobil signs this multi-year sponsorship deal, including NBA rights in China. The NBA hasn't had a motor oil sponsor for more than 15 years. In Pittsburgh, the Stanley Cup champion Penguins signed a colorful new arena naming rights deal. The facility is set to be renamed PPG Paints Arena for the coming year, replacing Console Energy as a title sponsor. Then MLS. They lag far behind other domestic pro sports in one respect. It's the only major U.S. sports league whose teams don't fly charter. Commissioner Don Garber cites competitive balance as to why it limits teams to 4 charter flights per year. Tokyo Olympics in 2020 may be the first games to feature 3-on-3 basketball. Asia's growing fascination in the game has given FIBA fresh hope he can get into the sport next Summer Olympics, the decision expected to be made next June. How about college? NCAA basketball champ Villanova plans on using its $23 million donation from an alumnus to renovate its pavilion. Villanova proving the time-tested equation that winning championships leads to new revenues, which in turn leads to better venues. And the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, finally placed a vague time frame for a new ballpark in Oakland for the A's, the first choice to rebuild the stadium on the Coliseum site, but is open to scheduling elsewhere in the region. Finally, what about Rutgers? They're receiving more money from the Big Ten than it would have if it were still in the AAC, but since joining the league 2 years ago, they've struggled to keep up with the quality of Big Ten football on the field, winning only 4 Big Ten games in the past 2 years competing in the conference. And that's Off the Beaten Track. Now we talk, and this is what you call chemistry, because I'm sure by 8, 9, 12 minutes into this podcast, you're bored as hell with me. So we bring in somebody with strong opinions and somebody who you know in the New England area and also nationally, Trenton Kisnerik. How are you?
I'm well, Rick. Thanks for inviting me to be a part of the podcast.
It's a regular invite, and we can decide afterward if regular means once or if regular means regular. I think regular will mean regular.
If we honestly like each other or not.
Yeah, deal. I think that's already fine, Midwest to Midwest. So bottom line of the first topic we want to talk about is we have a World Series that's made for the ages. The 71-year curse appears to be over. Now, I remember when I was at the series in 1908 at Wrigley, I said, look, this is going to happen every single year, and it didn't happen. So
We have StubHub tickets, by the way, going for $2,200 for the weekend already. And that's standing room. That's a obstructed view. So the bottom line of all of this, we don't care about prediction. We'll talk about that later. But what about the Cubs and the Indians? Could it be any better for baseball?
No, I don't think it could, because you have sort of this dissection of two starved cities, right? On the one hand, you have Chicago, which is, you know, one of the greatest cities in the world and has relative prosperity in comparison to, say, Cleveland. But as far as their baseball fans or their Cubs fans are concerned, they've been starved for a championship. And then on the flip side, you have Cleveland, which is, you know, sort of gone through a tough economic time. A lot of their businesses and their industries have failed. And up until this year, they hadn't won a championship in any sport since the 1950s. And now they have their second team in a championship series in less than what? Not even 6 months. So I don't think you could have a better sort of storyline. Plus, you have all of the other, if you really do pay attention to baseball, you've got the other side, which is Theo Epstein, who hired, Terry Francona to manage the Red Sox. The two of them together broke the curse, in 2004 with the Red Sox. And then Terry did it again with the Sox in 07. And then both him and Theo went their separate ways from the Red Sox. And then you've got John Lester and John Lackey and Andrew Miller, all these players that sort of have ties to one another on a former team that are now in two separate teams playing each other. And I shouldn't forget Mike Napoli either. Who could forget Napoli running shirtless through Boston?
Party at Napoli's, huh? Did you partake in any parties at Napoli's?
No, I did not partake in any parties at Napoli's. I definitely got like a Bud Light on top of the head when they won, maybe my face when they won the World Series. But that was the extent of my partying with Napoli.
By the way, lie detector tests are a conditioned precedent for participating in this podcast.
I will pass it with flying colors.
Yeah, I'm sure. Hey, so the other storyline about the whole Cubs issue, obviously, as you said, the civic pride really important. And without getting into politics, because we really want to avoid that, but I think it's fair to say, and I'm going to deal with this in my final take a little later, that when you consider all of the divisiveness and all of the rhetoric, it is really good that we now have sports in two cities, one in the Midwest and one also in the Midwest, as bringing people together, kind of the magnet, the catalyst, a very social, important, historical, generational kind of thing, don't you think?
Yeah, I was watching actually this morning, I was watching Craig Melvin on MSNBC when I was flipping through the news channels this morning, and he did a little monologue about how great it is to have this distraction, right? There's studies, I think the New York Times over the weekend had a front page article about how this election season is causing people so much anxiety. How great is it to have America's pastime? It had kind of gone to football for a while, but at least with this World Series, I think it's leaning back towards baseball, to just kind of be a very pure distraction for everybody and be able to just really get into the pageantry of sports. And, two fan bases, I think, that want to win desperately, but you can easily root for both of them, right? Which is the polar opposite of this election season, right? Where you feel like it's just the lesser of two evils. I think for most people, when you look at, unless you're like me and you're a Brewers fan, you look at Cubs Cardinals and you think, Cubs. I always think Cubs Cardinals, Cubs Indians.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a Freudian slip there.
Yeah.
You think of these two teams and you think, whoever wins, it's a cool story either way, and I'll be happy no matter what.
So are you old enough to remember the Harvey Kane days, or are you the next generation, the Yount Molitor days?
I'm more of the Yount Molitor days. So my first memory of playoff baseball, and they are few being from Milwaukee, is 1982. So I remember the 82 series. I was only five at the time, but there I have sort of pieced memories from it. This tells you just how sad state of baseball in Milwaukee. They had threw a parade when they lost the World Series. And I remember going to the parade and sitting on my dad's shoulders and seeing, Raleigh and Cooper and Gorman Thomas and Ben Ogilvy and Yount, I think was first year, and Molitor, all those guys come by in cars, and the streets of Milwaukee were packed, and we lost. But we threw him a parade anyway because we're a nice Midwestern town.
Yeah, but you know what? That's sad. I'll tell you what's really
sad.
My crack calculation of dates. It was my first year of law school, the year you were born. So let's move on to something very specific. I don't want to deal with that. Let's go to something else that has baseball as an interesting twist to it, but it is not only across the pond, but it's the other side of the world. You've got Tokyo and the 2020 Olympics and the idea of what they may do to assist the recovery in that northeastern prefecture of Japan, the earthquake, the tsunami, the nuclear disaster. They had a pretty bad 2011. And one of the things they're talking about is moving some of the games, meaning the baseball and softball opportunities, to those areas around Japan in 2020. So it's different than the legacy or non-legacy of Greece and of China. So what do we think of that?
You know, I think on the surface, it seems like a great idea. I was in Sochi, and I also covered the Olympics for NBC in Rio. And I will say this, particularly more so in Rio, I think, than Russia. But there's such a national pride to having the Olympics. You know, take out all the bureaucracy around an Olympics and people being angry about it. Once it's actually there, you can sense the swelling pride of this country being able to put on such pageantry and such a huge show for not just your country to see, or maybe even just one side of the hemisphere, but in the entire world to participate in. And to do that in a country and in a region that has had a lot of issues in terms of having to rebuild itself after a natural disaster, you know, I think it could be great. I think it would bring people together. The Japanese obviously love baseball. They love softball. It's one of their national sports. What I do worry about, having seen what some of these more and Japan's not an impoverished country, but you do wonder what the infrastructure is like in that part of Japan that went through such destruction. You start to wonder, okay, is how what kind of toll might it take on the athletes, right? Like, how do you get all of them there? Is it safe for them to be there? What are the accommodations like? You know, making sure that it is the right environment for them to compete in, and you're not putting them in a position that it might, you know, especially if major leaguers or even, you know, high-priced minor leaguers, top minor leaguers play for any of the countries, that you might jeopardize their further career, their further earnings by having them go play somewhere that might not be ready to handle that.
You know what the irony is, too, is that, well, first of all, they'll have 4 years to try to figure that out. If they make the decision now, it's 2020. So hopefully the accommodations first is really important. The irony is that 2 years later, we're going to have the Winter Olympics in a country that had the Summer Olympics a few years ago.
What a mess,
and
right?
This spot in Japan is known for its skiing, and they'll play summer baseball there. How screwed up is that?
It's become a point with the Olympics, and we got to be careful here. This is an NBC entity.
Yeah, it's NBC.
It is an NBC entity. But Mark
Lazarus will get over it. He'll be fine with this.
Think about the fact, and I would love to go to both Olympics. I'd be happy to cover them. But the fact that Beijing is hosting a summer and a winter Olympics, and the fact that they're going to have the winter Olympics in Beijing, some of the skiing events are going to have to be so far away that it's not even happening in Beijing. But this is a product, right, of the IOC and the way that they bargain off and auction off, I should say, these Olympic sites. Nobody wants them anymore, so this is what they're left with.
Yeah, and just remember, the choice they had for those particular Olympics was China again or Azerbaijan, which I can't even pronounce, let alone spell. So I think they probably made the right decision.
Azerbaijan, A-Z.
What's the capital? No, don't do it. What's the capital? Do you know?
Oh, God, I have no idea.
No, I think it's Baku, but we'll find out. We'll get the answer for the next podcast.
Okay, good. Sounds good. Ooh, does that mean I've been invited back for podcast number two?
Yes, yeah, two-thirds. Unless you really screw up this last segment, you're okay.
Okay.
Third segment, Josh Brown is no more. He can kick somewhere, but not in the NFL. And part of the issue is there a malaise in the NFL right now where we can't handle our bad actors, the domestic abuse policy? We're spinning footballs and jumping on goalposts. We have Brady out, but now back. Is it inherent? Is it one of those things where we've got a real problem on our hands, or is it just kind of temporary until the election's over?
That's the hard question to answer, right? And it's a question we won't be able to answer until next year. Is this an aberration? Is this because they have shown, ratings show that every election season, ratings in the NFL do go down. I don't know that they go down to this extent that they have this year, but I just feel like this time the problem runs a little bit deeper. One, I think the product itself, with the over-officiating, and you can't shake your tush just to celebrate a touchdown, and, you know, quarterbacks are, I think I can say tush. You can shake, you can't shake your tush, but you also can't deflate footballs, but hey, you have 20 charges of spousal abuse on your record, and hey, we're just going to sweep it under the rug and suspend you one game and then sign you to an extension. These are all real problems for the NFL, and also just the oversaturation. I mean, I'm going to be honest here. I haven't watched a single Thursday night game yet. And I would have watched this week because I'm a Packers fan, but I was boycotting because of the Josh Brown situation. But that's it. I mean, it's like it used to be appointment viewing, right? Now yeah. It's like, oh my God, there's another game on. Like even the game in London against the Rams and the Giants. Well, right. I certainly wasn't going to watch it because of Josh Brown, but you're like, Christmas. I'm getting up in the morning and starting at 9 a.m. after the last game just ended 36 hours earlier on a Thursday night, and it was kind of a stinker. Now it's again, and it's through Monday night.
Did it used to be in your life where four windows of uninterrupted NFL football was heaven? Or
oh, yeah. Never- Absolutely. Yeah. I used to look forward to, you know, my earlier days in September, that first weekend where you had college and pro football. It was awesome. But that was a time when football was Saturday college ball, Sunday NFL, and a Monday night game. Now it starts on Thursday. Shoot, in some college, in some realms in college, it starts on like Wednesday or Tuesday, depending on what time of the year it is. It's too much. And I think people also, when I watch now, and maybe this is me just getting older, but I watch and I used to see a big hit and think, yeah, man, hit him again, knock the snot out of him. Now I think, oh God, is that guy going to remember his daughter's name in 5 years? I just think there's a different awareness around the sport now, and that is part of the problem. I don't see these ratings rebounding in the past the way they have before.
Well, let's see what the post-election rebound is. I find it interesting that it's part of the NFL's own doing because, you know, those Thursday night games, as we know, were geared toward division rivalries. The Packers-Bears sucked, but it was supposed to be a good game.
Right.
And this week, here's your question. If you had let's say 3 hours of Clinton-Trump nonstop or 3 hours of Jaguars-Titans, which would be the issue.
Those are two bad options, Rick. I don't want either of those options.
Hey,
I want like
way,
3 hours of Stranger Things on Netflix.
That's the right choice. I visited your office last week. I'll come say hi next time. Thank God you only have one story, because if like you were in a 5 or 6 story building, you'd probably jump off the fifth story if you had that choice.
If that was my choice, I wouldn't want it. I don't want anything to do with either. But I don't know what I'm going to watch on Thursday night, but I can guarantee you it is not Jaguars Titans.
Well, then we have a date for 2 weeks from now. And the one good thing about that, by the way, is when we next convene, the election
will have a president.
Will be either happen or over. Yeah, we'll have a president.
Well,
I don't know if we'll have a leader.
Allegedly, we'll have a president.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Well, I don't know if we'll have a leader, but we'll have a president.
Yes.
So thank you for reminding me that my first year at Harvard Law School was your first year on Earth. I hate you.
Thank you for reminding me I'm not smart enough to get into Harvard Law School. I hate you. Goodbye.
Wow. Whatever you got. See you in a couple weeks. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Now it's time for Snap, the top five issues with teams off field this week in the NFL, 5-1. Number five, the Dallas Cowboys. During NFL owners' meetings last week, Cowboys owner Jerry Jones expressed his displeasure with the league mandate precluding teams from putting highlights on social media. Jones claimed game highlights were team-generated content and clubs should be able to do what they want with them on social media. Jones also expressed his belief that if the league can post the videos, then the team should do so as well. Number four, the Atlanta Falcons. Construction of the new Falcons Mercedes-Benz Stadium nearing completion. Falcons have ordered $209 million worth of changes since the start of construction on the venue, but the Falcons and not the taxpayers are financially responsible for any overages. Number three, the Oakland Raiders. The city of Oakland's hopes for keeping the Raiders in town rest with the Fortress Investment Group, a money management firm in San Francisco that boasts a $72 billion asset pool. Fortress Investment Group happens to be led by Hall of Famer Ronnie Lott. He plans to persuade Raiders ownership to build a new stadium at the site of the current Coliseum, a long task ahead. Number two, the Washington Redskins. The U.S. Supreme Court denied the Redskins' appeal on their trademark case. The appeal attempted to challenge the law in question over offensive trademarks. But all isn't lost. The Supreme Court can still make precedent on the matter in another case in which they're already hearing. The case involves a rock band, but the principle remains the justices whether the same trademark law violates the First Amendment or not. The Redskins are valued at approximately $2.5 billion, half of which can be directly linked to its intellectual property, according to Forbes. It's no wonder why team owner Daniel Snyder vowed never to change the name. And number one, the Jacksonville Jaguars, number one in something. Well, the NFL continues its color rush initiative with alternate uniforms this week. Look for the Jaguars to wear the all-new yellow mustard look, for the Titans to wear all baby blue. I'm not a big fan of the mustard, Jaguars quarterback Blake Bortles told reporters in Tennessee, the master of the understatement. I think they could have done a better job. I think they could have chosen a different color. Several teams this season playing on Thursday night wearing alternate color rush uniforms. The reasons vary from similar color schemes to colorblind issues. How about just get better on the field? It's time for my final take. Red or blue, win or lose, pretty much everyone's going to breathe a sigh of relief when this toxic presidential election is over in a couple of weeks. Then we can go back to our humdrum lives, absent controversy or drama. Grab a bag of chips, settle in on the couch, and watch the NFL. Wait. You know, more than ever, it feels as though NFL games and much of sports in general doesn't give us the usual respite from the complicated world outside our rec rooms. New York Giant Josh Brown's domestic abuse scandal, the lingering Colin Kaepernick national anthem protest drama, and the declining TV numbers feel like a perfect NFL storm that's the most interesting water cooler conversation in sports today. Imagine, if you will, a Fortune 500 company with the same set of circumstances around it. For sports as an escape hatch from life, the controversies couldn't really come at a worse time. The Brown allegations echo sexual harassment charges levied against Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, and Kaepernick's nationally televised protests bring to the sidelines the same issues of police distrust and racial injustice currently being dealt with down ballot by candidates across the country. But in a more literal sense, this year's politics are directly impacting sports, as North Carolina's lost over a half dozen major sporting events and their attendant economic impact, including the 2017 NBA All-Star Game, which fled to New Orleans. The controversial HB2 law is to blame. And Trump is likewise facing the migration of major golf championships away from his Trump-branded clubs in the U.S. and abroad. And while we cannot separate sports and politics, let's focus for a moment on how sports heals, not divides. Virginia Tech presents a fantastic example. After the 2007 campus massacre, the first such large-scale incident in the U.S. that they were forced to deal with on a national and international scope, sports not only provided emotional solace, but the football team alone poured in $26 million back into Virginia Tech athletics and in turn generated $34 million that was used, among other things, to establish student wellness programs, boost security, and fund important research. In Sacramento, the high-tech $535 million gem Golden One Center was built largely on the tall political clout of former NBA point guard and current Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson. And in Indy, former Mayor Greg Ballard, Guggenheim Insurance maven Dan Taurus, and LPGA Commissioner Mike Wan just announced the Indy Women in Tech Championship presented by Guggenheim, which will drive awareness and funding for specific women in tech initiatives, particularly focused on robotics, STEM, and career transitioning for those re-entering the workforce. Regardless of what happens on November 8, let's remember that more often than not, sports is an instrument of social good, and that's a game we can all get behind. That's our show for today. We'd like to thank Steve Pagliuca for being our kickoff premier guest. Good luck to his Celtics. And join us in a couple of weeks when we focus on other issues in the sports world and we go beyond the scoreboard. Search and subscribe to our Beyond the Scoreboard podcast on iTunes, Audio Boom, and Stitcher, and Google Play. Our 15 to watch, you'll see each week and hear each week, and every other week, the bigger podcasts for Beyond the Scoreboard. Any questions, comments, concerns, find me at Rick Haro. That's my Twitter handle. It's a trillion-dollar business out there, and we'll talk about it each and every week. I'm the sports professor, Rick Haro. Thanks for listening.